Thank you. Be seated.
The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Berry Property Management versus Police.
May I please report, Mr. Roger Townsend.
May it please the court. This case involves a rape at a town home with a judgment that now stands at $16 million plus interest. There are several ironies in the case. The first one is perhaps how the BTPA claim arose. The case was originally filed about a month after the incident as a negligence case. Discovery was undertaken. Police records were subpoenaed that showed that this crime had occurred in a low-crime area with no history of violent crime, and only after that were the pleadings amended to add the DTPA claim. Usually, as the court knows, you would have a DTPA claim first because of the notice requirements. The second irony is that the evidence of gross negligence and the evidence of knowing conduct seem to conflict. They say that we're guilty of gross negligence because we're so ignorant of what the law required us to do in terms of security. But to try to uphold the DTPA penalty damages, they say that we knew everything and did it intentionally or consciously. A final irony is that with the size of the case, the interest is running $200 per hour. So I'm going to be brief in my remarks for that reason, if none other. But also that the limited relief that the Court of Appeals gave us was more than offset by the post-judgment interest. So in real terms of dollars, we've had no relief, and we're happy to be here. You've granted writ on one point, and because of the time limitations, I'm going to honor that and concentrate my remarks on that point. That is the award of both $5 million in punitives and $3 million in additional DTPA penalty damages. We think the award is contrary to the law, both to the common law and to the statutory law. The common law begins, for our purposes, with the Birchfield decision of this court, in which it very clearly held that you cannot get both DTPA penalty damages and common law exemplary damages without distinct findings of actual damages. Now, in our case, we do have two sets of actual damages findings. One is tied to the negligence claim, one to the DTPA claim. And it is true that the damage amounts are slightly different. The elements in each question are identical. But the jury, for some unknown reason, awarded $13,760 more to the negligence claim than to the DTPA claim. No one has been able to find out why the jury did that. There is no different proof in the record. There's no evidence to support the award of different amounts. And another irony that even the trial court observed on the record is that it seems strange that the jury gave more money with the negligence claim, which has a higher causation threshold, than to the DTPA claim, which has the lower causation threshold. If anything, you would think it would be the other way around. But our point is that without proof of different damages under each of those causes of action, they cannot get punitive damages, and that Birchfield, by short extension, mandates that conclusion. Your rule in Birchfield is, of course, consistent with many other cases from this court and the lower courts, that you have to have separate tort damages to support the award of punitive damages. The Reed case is the leading case. There are many others. Even when you have what we all think of as a tort, whether it be a tortious interference claim or a fraud claim, things that in the casebook or treatises would be called a tort, you still don't get punitive damages unless you can show separate actual tort damages. So without proof of that, they're not entitled to both the DTPA penalty and the punitives. We believe this rule is also consistent with the one satisfaction rule that the court has followed on many occasions and again very recently in this precise type of case. It's true that the one satisfaction rule talks primarily about actual damages, but I think the policy at work there applies to the punitive damage context as well. You are trying to say if there is one injury, you only get one compensation for that injury. Punitive damages have been held to be in part compensable damages. This court decided the Hofer versus Lavender case in the mid-1980s where you made that very holding. In our particular case, one of the instructions on punitive said that you can consider attorney's fees, things like that, which is, of course, a reason to compensate the plaintiff for claims they might not otherwise recover. But, of course, in the DTPA context, they get their attorney's fees recovered under the statute. So, again, you have this sort of double recovery idea for the single injury. The statutory law also seems to agree with us. There's a section of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, 41.004B, that says you cannot get punitive damages if you've had your damages multiplied under another statute. And we contend that the DTPA mechanism of penalty damages is just what that statute is talking about. The DTPA has a provision that says you cannot get common law punitive damages for the same act or practice. And I think that's what the Court of Appeals based its decision on against us and what my opponents will argue to you this morning. But the DTPA statute does not say that you have to get punitive damages in that context. It simply says that you may. I think we could all say that the common law requirements are still engrafted on there, that you have to have different damages under the separate causes of action. You would also have to have, even under the terms of the DTPA, a separate act or practice. We pointed out in our reply brief that they are relying on the very same conduct to try to show knowing conduct under the DTPA as they are using to show gross negligence. The act and practice has to do with her security. That's what we've been held liable for. It's the same. So I don't think the DTPA avails them in that case. Finally, to consider what would be the remedy in connection with this, because they don't have separate tort actual damages, then I think the punitive damages claim has to be stricken. They have elected previously to recover under the DTPA because they felt that gave them the maximum recovery, and that's consistent with this court's decisions that you let people collect under the theory that gives them the maximum recovery. With the DTPA actuals, the DTPA penalty, and the attorney's fees, they get a larger recovery. Some courts have indicated that parties can piecemeal together different findings under different causes of action to add up to the largest recovery. I'm not sure that this court has ever so held. You talk about the issue in Birchfield just briefly, and you seem to be saying that you can collect under a measure of recovery or a cause of action, but you don't seem to go so far as to say that you can piecemeal different theories together. I think that would be consistent with the reason you have an election of causes of action. They do mean something. So I would suggest that they not be allowed to both keep attorney's fees and get the punitive damages. The attorney's fees are under the DTPA cause. The punitives would be under the gross negligence cause. And as I mentioned before, another reason for that or to prevent that would be that here the punitives did include an award for attorney's fees, or at least the jury was instructed that it could do that. So I think the proper remedy there would be to strike the punitive damages award and make them go purely under their DTPA recovery. I would like to address just briefly a couple of other points, and then I will yield some time to the court. In our reply brief, we have focused on the new and independent cause instruction, which enabled the jury to award damages for the criminal's escape from jail, which did cause Ms. Bliski a great deal of suffering. The evidence shows that she made remarkable recovery from the rape, given the traumatic experience that is, but that she had extreme problems and had to be hospitalized for several days based on the escape from jail. We believe that the failure to instruct the jury about new and independent cause enabled the plaintiffs to augment the damages there beyond what they should have been.
Mr. Thompson, in that regard, it's impossible to know what the jury did in that regard. There was no segregation of damages. The jury was not asked what amount of money for mental anguish, for the trauma, and what amount of money for the aggravation. So
no.
How are we to know?
No,
did the jury give any amount?
There is no way to know, Your Honor, but there is the presumption that the jury follows the court's instructions. And so the presumption would be that the jury followed the court's instruction that told it that the aggravation is recoverable as a result here, or the escape from jail, is considered something that we can be liable for. That's why we made the objection as a comment on the weight of the evidence, because it wasn't even, you may consider whether this was foreseeable to Barry or not. It said it is recoverable. And that was the basis for our objection, that it's a comment.
He did not request the court to include the language, if any, as is usually the custom.
No, we did not. We did not on that instruction. The other thing your question goes to, Your Honor, I think is, again, this problem of broad form submission that you're having to deal with in so many cases. Do you request it as a question or do you request it as an instruction? Here we had the instruction being given, so we made the objection to the instruction, and we also requested our alternative instruction, raising our inferential rebuttal point. But I don't think it's fair to say we had the burden to, in addition, ask for a different question there. The other point is the 11 jurors point, because the Court of Appeals, for whatever reason, did not cite your decision in Walter, even though we plastered it all over the brief and did everything we could to raise it. There are a lot of cases that reach the same result as Waller, which is that unless you have a physical disability or a mental disability, you have to have a trial by 12 jurors. You can have a verdict by fewer, but you have to have 12 in the deliberations. And what typically happens is either that the parties agree to go forward with a fewer number, or the court does, in fact, declare a mistrial. Here, both parties moved for a mistrial. In fact, I think Mr. Edwards actually initiated it, but the judge denied that request. That is a constitutional right that we think is important. Otherwise, the Constitution would not speak to 12 jurors. We have other points in the brief, and if I had, you know, a couple of hours, we could go back and forth on those, but I don't want to take up the court's time unless there are further questions.
You're saying you have a constitutional right to a jury by 12?
Yes, sir. That is in the Constitution. And the rules as well speak of that, but it is a constitutional right.
Well, how about a county court of law jury? Six. Or a federal court where you have less than six?
Right.
Less than 12?
Right.
I'd
have to go back and read the constitutional provision to see if it speaks only to district courts or not, Your Honor. But it definitely speaks of 12 jurors.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent. Or argument from the respondent.
May I please report, Mr. W. James Cronzer, the argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Townsend. I have a well-known co-counsel with me today, Bill Edwards, who I think the court knows from other occasions. What I like about Bill asking me to get in this with him, I think it makes me on the right side. If this is not the right side, I know it is the righteous side. I like Bill, like Mr. Townsend, believe we should limit our arguments as much as possible to the point upon which the writ was granted, and that is that the effect of the judgment of the courts below was to duplicate damages for penalties under the DTPA and the common law of punitive damage principles that the court's familiar with. We differ on what the rule of law is and has been since this court's decision in Mayo versus John Hancock. We, of course, like he said with his case, we have plastered it over everything we've ever written in this case because it establishes the principle upon which we stand. That you, since Perkins, you can't recover actual squats, but the statute 1743 of the DTPA, the Mayo case, and yea, we say Birchfield, all establish that extra damages, either at common law or under the statute, may be recovered by the party plaintiff, even though the jury was not entitled to know that its award on the actual damages was going to be limited to one. Now, the statute, let me do the best thing on it, the shortest thing, it's hard for this gentleman here to be short, but we have the guy that's written on this, Professor Alderman from the University of Houston School of Law, in his works, 1993, on the Lawyer's Guide to the Texas DTPA. I put it as succinctly as possible and relies, if Your Honor's please, on the decisions that we rely on. Cumulative recovery of penalties, however, should be permitted for multiple acts in all cases, even if the multiple acts, which are the basis of the consumer's complaint, produce the same actual damages. Can't be stated more clearly and succinctly than that analysis. It's based on Mayo, and it's based on even Birchfield. And the reason we differ on Birchfield is we have, unlike Birchfield, in which there was only one set of issues leading to one damage issue. In this case, following the teaching of Birchfield, in the trial court, Mr. Edwards submitted both the negligence concepts and the DTPA concepts, each resulting in their own damage finding. The punitive damages were different than the penalty damages under the DTPA by a couple of $1 million. There again, indicating the jury was assessing what it believed to be its powers under the instructions of the court.
You mean to say a couple of $1,000?
A couple of million. I made the mistake there.
On punitives?
I'm not that old. I can't recognize that difference. and I think it won't, the court might not like much reading, but I do want to say that in the Birchfield case, the court said, in the absence of separate and distinct findings of actual damages on both the acts of negligence and the deceptive acts or practices, an award of exemplary damages and statutory treble damages would be necessarily predicated upon the same findings of actual damages and would amount to double recovery of punitive damages. There were different acts. The jury found DTPA acts and negligent conduct, leading to the different damage issues. Subsequent to the decision in Birchfield, and we've cited those cases, the courts of appeals have made the same distinction we're talking about here. If you have separate acts leading to different damages, or leading to damages under each theory. In that event, following Birchfield, you can award, subject only to claims of excessiveness or that sort of thing, on both lines of inquiry. The no case since Birchfield has suggested to the contrary. We get dangerously close to agreement, which is hard for me to understand when I'm dealing with Mr. Townsend, when he, in the last filing they did, had this to say. The respondent has conceded that where there is one wrongful act, there can only be one penalty. Double penalties for the same act are improper. And we stand on that statement we made then and make now. But the acts here are different. Just as these cases in analyzing Birchfield after point out, we have the DTPA fact that under her lease, she was entitled to have a latch inside that you couldn't get in from the outside. She asked for that. It was denied to her. We have on the negligence side, as Chief Caldwell, former Chief of Police in Houston, said, the most unbelievable conduct of any security risk he had covered. They left these keys, the compartment keys, loose in their main office. For $30 they could have bought a key box to keep those keys in. They had the leases which described women by their size, hair, weight, and everything. And that's what this guy did. He went in there, got the key out of that box, looked over the leases for information of who he thought might be the most attractive to his rapacious nature. And that's how he went, and that's how he got in. They did not, he just unlocked the door. Now, that's what I say. I think I'm in on the righteous side of this cause. It is incredible. She was a nurse, a wonderful lady. The damage proof was overwhelming. But when we come to the bottom line, you can even concede arguendo that there was only one indivisible injury suffered by her as a result of the attack. But that is not what the court was deciding in either Birchfield or in Mayo. It is not the similarity of the acts or of the damage. But just like in Landers, when you have an indivisible type of damage finding result, who should be required to separate it? Damages weren't found to be the same. How do we know what the jury was doing? How can this court now start, after all these many moons, years, start going behind the veil of the jury when it is submitted in accordance with this court's instructions and ends up being exactly what you say and exactly what the statute itself says? The statute is, that he says, is not clear. And then I will move to the other points very quickly. The remedies provided in this subchapter are in addition to any other procedures or remedies provided for in any other law. Provided, however, that no recovery shall be permitted under both this subchapter and another law of both actual damages and penalties for the same act or practice. Every case after Birchfield that involves separate acts, and this one does, the act of not furnishing her request in violation of the DTPA is a separate act, but for which the act, it wouldn't occur. The same is true. If they hadn't done the negligent, proximate cause, if the court please, findings, with respect to leaving the keys loose and the leases loose, the act probably would not have ever occurred. Those are concurring causes at best from their standpoint, and they can't avoid the bottom line of Birchfield and Mayo unless the court wants to write Mayo out of the law and the statute itself. For me,
Mr. Ken, the plaintiff under multiple theories recover multiple awards of attorney's fees.
Well,
I'll say that portion, the jury's instructed that as part of the punitive damage award, they may consider attorney's fees as a statutory remedy under the DTPA. They may recover attorney's fees. Let's say for a breach of the a breach of contract, could they recover three times attorney's fees?
Well, let me answer that in this way. Attorney's fees are provided under the DTPA. The finding here of attorney's fees is related to that damage under the DTPA. You are not, if you're on the police, entitled to an independent recovery of attorney's fees in connection with negligent conduct. Period. You cannot under the decisions of this court where you're talking about punitive damages, have the jury consider other expenses that they might not otherwise get under their actual damage claims. They could certainly appear to a layperson as being overlapping, but we say to you, one is the statutory right to collect, and one is the common law, not right to collect, but inclusion of that as an instruction in the exemplary damages. Any other questions on the points granted it on? I do want to briefly mention the point about the jurors. What this argument would do would be to undo what this court had the courage to do and did do when it changed to a 10-2 verdict. The case law since that time has clearly held that if you get one juror who has a defective problem, that doesn't make any difference if you have a 10.
What was the defect here, Mr. Cron?
Well, this fellow was seen talking with an insurance person.
But did the trial court make a statement?
Yes, out in the hall.
Didn't the trial judge say there is no doubt in my mind that he can follow the instructions and be fair?
That's true, but he also heard the testimony of his bailiff to the effect that the guy had said he was reluctant to serve because he might hurt a friend of his. That was insurance.
Who was not a party.
Who was not a party. I don't know. That's correct. But what we're talking about is both the old discretionary rule, a judge on how much evidence you have to send a juror home, and also whether or not, if you wrongly did that, whether or not the verdict can still stand. And that is the effect and impact not only of your changing the 10-2 rule, it necessarily does. But you started this problem after the old TEIA versus Wade, something I fear and hate to say it probably preceded any of the people on this bench. But Wade was the case in which the juror did not dispose on voir dire. They'd had prior claims. And the argument by the defense was they had the same constitutional right to a juror not contaminated by any influence. And it led to a rash of reversals, resulting in Childers versus Texas Employers by this court. And it's time for us to recognize the harmless error rule should be applied. And you amended Rule 327 and applied to jury misconduct or jury matters of this type had to be shown to be harmful error. Together with the 10-2 rule, how can it possibly be harmful error? And in Tamborello versus Welch, which we didn't cite, this court held that one juror unconstitutionally disqualified is not enough to override the harm requirements. And so it is. We find it almost incomprehensible to believe that this court, after the years it struggled with some relaxation, the legislature wouldn't do it, of the 12-0 jury thing, and to overrule the old way principle, which it did, is now going to go back full circle and start saying that a juror who made these statements and did these things and the judge released, he has no discretion. You're just going to say the Constitution applies. He has no discretion to release people who are disqualified or disabled. I hope the court won't do that.
Do you claim that the court has inherent power? In other words, the sources of the authority which you described to us are the authority to accept a 10-2 verdict?
A lot of them rose in the days of Wade and in their children cases, from the juror not disposing. Matter of fact, some of you may have seen in the Houston papers about a new trial, or this right up here in Austin, where the the grand juror didn't disclose his situation.
I guess my question wasn't clear, but really what I want to know is, what is the source of a district judge's authority to excuse a juror?
Well, the Constitution and the statute rule say that he can disqualify down to 9 to go on and complete the trial.
So here the judge could have gone down to 9 and still gotten a verdict?
That's, well, of course, he could have then got into the problem of there not being enough jurors for the 10-2 rule to operate. But he did. This is a case where one juror, not shown to have any contaminating forces, other than, as Judge Gonzalez said, that he thought he could be fair, but he was going to let him go because of what everybody did and said. We have cases that we've cited where guys come into the courtroom with a little too much beer after lunch, and the court sent them home. And that's been upheld as a disqualifying factor. But I really don't want to limit my argument in that regard to whether there was any disqualification or whether he acted properly or whether you're going to take away discretion in those instances of the trial court. I want to put it on the broad basis that a single disqualified juror, we can't go back to square to the beginning and say the Constitution applies to where this court cannot, as it has done, and with considerable, I thought, courage at the time, when it did the 10-2 rule. Now that's backwards into the parade.
Under your argument, the trial judge could have reduced the size of this jury based on his impression of disability of the juror to serve, prejudice, bias, or whatever, could have reduced it to 10 jurors constitutionally.
Yeah, but Judge Cronin, that isn't the case before you.
But that is where your argument leads.
Well, I'm not trying to lead it there. I'm just saying he let one go, and we're here to affirm this case for Ms. Blisky.
I want to test the limits of your theory of what you're arguing. But
I hope if that happens, I'll be hired by somebody else at a later date.
Under your theory, by analogy, by applying the 10-2 rule, the trial judge would have been within his constitutional authority to have a 10-member jury in this case.
More accurately, it is you don't have harm when you release a juror that doesn't come up to make for the necessary juror to serve.
As you well know, we have separate inquiries whether it's error, and then whether secondarily whether that's harmful error. And you claim that it would be error, but the error would be harmless, or do you claim there is no error?
I claim that since the amendment of Rule 237 by this court, and Chilton versus Texas Employers, in which you took out these questions of jurors misanswering, not doing right, and made it a pure question of harm. You take that factor, and then, gosh, I don't know how many cases, Judge, there's been since you changed that rule, the old Wade rule, it was a constitutional right to have all of them tell it exactly the way it really was. And if their records after trial showed differently, then you get a new trial. That rule became a bad rule. And you so stated in the amendments to Rule 327 and in the subsequent case law, including decisions of this court. And I say when it's required that it produce harm, and that's what any juror situation, like one juror or two, going off funny, Tamburello versus Welch, said, one not going to be bad on harm, but three is too much. You call it a materially unfair trial if people didn't get three that they were entitled to on peremptory challenges.
How does a losing plaintiff or a losing defendant demonstrate harm in this context?
The judge, if you have a 10-2 or a 10-3 or 10-0, where's the harm?
Argument is harmful error is the test, but you can never show harm as long as you have the 10-person verdict.
That's correct, and it's all the same people, the very rule the court had the courage to pass. And if it weren't so, well, that rule is down the pipe. Thank you. I'm sorry to have labored so long.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Gonzalez, I can answer your question now. The constitutional provision talks about district courts shall be comprised of 12 jurors. That's Article 5, Section 13. Most of my opponent's arguments about the juror point are answered on page 19 of our application for writ of error. There's nothing inconsistent with our position and the 10-2 juror rule. The very constitutional provision on which we rely says that you can excuse up to three jurors if they become disabled, and that the legislature can authorize a verdict by fewer than 12. But it doesn't say that you can have a jury of fewer than 12 unless they're disabled. And that's where the Waller case comes in, because it defined what is disabled. It says it is severe mental incapacity or physical incapacity. His example of the beer drinking is one more in our list of cases that talk about physical incapacity. But in this situation, where it's something that could have come up on voir dire or didn't, or the witness answered wrong, usually the remedy is a mistrial in those circumstances.
Are you saying that's the only remedy?
Yes, unless the parties agree to go forward with fewer than 12. The harmless error rule we've discussed at page 25. Many cases of this court dealing with constitutional right to trial by jury have not applied the harmful error rule. I think the most recent is Powers versus Palacios, which was excluding minorities from the jury system. And you had no hesitancy to reverse that case with no discussion whatsoever of reversible error. There does seem to be a different rule invoked when you're dealing in this field. The best example is Judge Calvert's, Chief Justice Calvert's opinion in the Van Zandt case, where he says at point blank, there is no harmless error rule of constitutional right to trial by jury. The reason that's significant is Chief Justice Calvert was the leading scholar pushing for the adoption of the harmless error rule, and he wrote the leading articles in that field, and yet at the same time he was doing that, he was issuing an opinion from this court saying it doesn't apply to this type of issue.
Would you speak briefly to the contention that you did not fully preserve error on the issue that we granted writ on, that you did not object all the times that you should have to the submission of extra damages?
I don't recall that they've made the contention that we have not preserved error in that connection. We certainly raised it in all the post-trial motions, which would be the time.
This was on objections to the charge.
At objections to the charge, I don't think it would be appropriate, because a party is entitled to submit as many theories as possible and then elect under your greatest recovery. If it's only till the jury answers it that you see you have a problem, that they have awarded the same damages for the two different answers, those types of things. I don't think it's right for objection until post-verdict.
In that regard, Mr. Towns, I want to ask you, Mr. Cronzer has cited some cases that he says stand for the proposition, and at least some writers that say if you have separate, distinct wrongful conduct, you can award punitive damages for each of those conducts. And then he cites the failure to provide the night latch as being one basis for the DTPA damages, and then the display of the keys being the basis for the negligence damages. How can you ever, if that is correct, then how can we address whether or not there's inappropriate awarding of punitive damages here without a previous objection that the punitive damages weren't tied to specific separate acts of conduct? I mean, how do we know that the award under DTPA was because of the night latch, when in fact it could have been because of the display of the keys, it seems to me your problem is having not objected to that deserved. How do we ever get to the question that this wasn't awarded for separate acts?
Well, at that point you have to get to whether there's actually evidence under the DTPA and what that evidence is. The way we display the keys is not actionable under the DTPA in any stretch of the imagination, and they had never contended that until their brief here, where they point to that as evidence of knowing conduct, but it was not identified as any kind of DTPA action. The DTPA claim is three. One is that we should have provided her a deadbolt lock. The problem they have with that is that the statute says the owner does that not the apartment managers, which we were. And there's a specific statutory exclusion that says apartment managers acting, or if you're acting as an agent, which the manager is, you don't have that duty. His second DTPA theory was unconscionability. And I've got no answer to that other than to say this does not meet the decisions on unconscionability that this court has put forward in the past. You know, gross disparity of value, those sorts of things. His third theory, and this is the one that nobody seems to understand, and if I may, I'd like to just walk you through it. It's a little technical. Is that we falsely represented contract had rights that it did not have. That's what the charge says, and that was his theory. That is not what his evidence shows. His evidence is the flip of that. We did not say to Ms. Bliski, the contract gives you a right to a deadbolt latch, when the contract did not. That would be actionable under his instruction because we would have told her that it has a right that it does not have. What we said is you don't have the right to a deadbolt lock when the contract gave her that right. That's why one of my points is that really what we have here is a breach of contract case. Now, nobody seems, you know, ever to buy that, but if you read it technically, that's all they proved on DTPA. The negligence claim, if I may just finish very briefly, the problem they've got there is our duty point. They want to focus on what was the negligence once the criminal is inside the building. We want to focus on did we have the duty to expect the criminal ever to break into the building to begin with.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will now take a lunch recess and we will resume at 2 o'clock. The marshal will please adjourn the court.
Audience, please rise. Foyer.